Good afternoon. Welcome. We're going to open up the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Today is March 17th, 2015, and we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 5034 relating to the Public Employee Retirement System. John, what do we need to be thinking about first?
Co-chairs and members of the subcommittee, the agency has provided its responses to subcommittee questions yesterday, and those are now out on OLIS. And there's one thing I'd like to maybe give advance notice to today with the agency. They are doing something quite impressive, and that is their strategic plan that they've worked on with Mass Ingenuity. They have translated all that to specific measures that the agency will get into in detail today. And that is a unique approach compared to other agencies. So they've looked at all their processes and procedures, dissected those, looked how to resolve problems, timeliness, quality, and other such measures. And so it's quite an impressive effort and an extensive effort that it's been agency-wide. And so as the agency goes through those, I just would like to call that out in particular as something that is it is unique among some of the strategic plans you've seen that other agencies have presented, a far greater level of detail and effort that they've gone through. So thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Director, welcome. Everyone, whoever's coming up, come on up.
Okay.
So we have an hour and 25 minutes, so I'm going to turn it over to you and let you run with it.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee. For the record, again, I'm Steve Rodman, the Executive Director at PERS. We're starting on the day two presentation, and so we're starting where we left off. Sorry, I need to roll this forward. So we left off yesterday looking at the rise in transactions of the agency and the increased volume of people we're serving and the types of service we're providing. So the challenge, of course, with that situation is to address it without losing touch with the service levels that you're trying to maintain. And that's where the measurements that LFO staff referred to are really helpful in driving our strategic initiatives, and were helpful also in honing in on where we were going to be putting special effort through our policy option packages that we've submitted for the 2015-17 legislature. So this is our fundamentals.
Mr. Chair.
Of course.
I'm sorry. Maybe could you go back one slide, please,
sure.
Mr. Rodman? If you showed this yesterday and I wasn't paying attention, I apologize. But 870,000 online benefit estimates, a jump of 500% in a year? Is that all our fault for what we did in 2013?
No, Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, we're measuring better. So if you look at the footnote, that 2014 includes all of the activity related to estimates, not just the new estimates.
Okay.
This is people looking at their old estimates and revising or changing the parameters of the estimate. So it's a better picture of how much planning resource is being used by our membership in trying to figure out what they're going to get out of the benefit system at the end of their careers. But it is a significant jump, you're right.
Okay, thank you.
Part of that has to do with additional functionality that we deployed into OMS in 2014 as well that made that a little more relevant to folks. So anyway, carrying on, this is our fundamentals map. This is a product that I'm sure you've seen before from other agencies. As LFO staff alluded to, the Mass Ingenuity structure is something that several agencies have used to organize their planning and management system. I'll get into more detail in the individual pieces, but this is just the placemat, as I call it, overall, that shows you the big picture of the agency. It defines what we do, it defines the processes we follow to do that work, and it also establishes how that connects up to our key goals and outcome measures, so we know whether we're doing a good job quantitatively rather than just intuitively suggesting whether we are or not. So part of that fundamentals map, right at the top, of course, is our mission statement. Why does this agency exist? We exist to serve the people of Oregon, to administer public employee benefit trusts, to pay the right person the right benefit at the right time. We boil it down as simply as that, but there's some components of that that I think are important to emphasize. We do view our service to the people of Oregon. We are efficient and effective in striving to administer those public employee trusts, but they are also public employee trusts. They are money that is given to us for limited purposes, and that is to benefit our members exclusively. So the funds that we do expend have to have a direct connection and benefit to the members that we serve. And we take that very importantly. And the last part is really just the condensed version of what everybody's mission is in the agency, and that is, again, to pay the right person the right benefit at the right time. So the standard against which we measure ourselves is that. The second element of this is our shared vision, which we define as honoring your public service through secure retirement benefits. If I could get a little personal, if you remember a few years ago, there was the shooting at the Clackamas Mall. And as I was watching the news coverage of that from my home, realizing that my wife had not chosen that day to do her Christmas shopping at the mall, thank goodness, you saw hundreds of police officers from all different jurisdictions and state police responding to that emergency. And it struck me that every person rushing into that mall was a member of mine. And one of the things that really resonated with me was the mission we have in honoring their public service. And that was a key moment to me in just putting the phrasing together or philosophy together about public service and how we serve a role in making sure that everybody who's running into that mall to do their job does not have in the back of their head, how's my retirement doing? Because that's what we are there to take care of. So.
Johnson. That's a pretty tough act to follow, but I'm going to ask you a follow-on question about not running into the building worrying about their retirement. There was a period of time when I think the agency was struggling doing calculations that were accurate and timely, but accurate more than timely. And then once an error was made, either in favor of the retiree or in favor of the agency, correcting that misapplication of money. Tell us, against this very lofty set of shared visions and core values, how are you doing on the mechanics of the back room in telling me to the dime what my retirement is, or I say mine, I'm saying any member?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, we're doing very much better than we used to. There's always room for improvement, and by that I mean with a system that has as many components into calculating an individual's benefit, there will be some nuances that we may miss time to time. But we used to have an accuracy measured in the 80s, 80%. We have, as a key performance measure, as you'll see later, a 100% accuracy rating is our target. And over the last 2 years, we're coming in 98% in that accuracy.
Mr. Chair, I would just observe the fact that the room is not bristling with representatives of various groups that are PERS beneficiaries is testimony to the fact that things have gotten better. But I wanted it on the record, particularly for the benefit of our newer members who may not have realized that the agency struggled, and improvements have been made, and I think that's an important part of the hearing's record.
Yeah, I think that's a great observation. I was thinking about that earlier. As we were starting, the room's not full of people.
Cranky, cranky people.
Cranky yeah. people.
Well,
let's continue.
Public testimony is tomorrow. So. So our core values and operating principles also support our vision. Our core values were developed through discussions with our staff. These were not things that we just made up. We went back to our staff and engaged them in a conversation about what do we want to value as an organization. And that's where we came out with these values that we're now reflecting upon as we complete our strategic plan. But integrity, obviously, Senator Johnson, to your point, if I tell you you're entitled to a certain amount of money, I've got to have the integrity to back that up. And if I don't act with integrity and confidence and professionalism, you're going to live the rest of your retirement in doubt that I've done the right job. So that's why that's one of our core values.
Conversely, not the benefit to the member, but you have a fiduciary responsibility to the citizens to not be cavalier, and the taxpayers to not be cavalier with handing out the benefits, and when there is an error on that side, to aggressively go after it.
Absolutely. Co-Chair Smith and Senator Johnson, as I said at the start of the mission statement, we serve the people of Oregon, so they must have confidence in our integrity that we are administering the system responsibly. And so that's why another one of our values and underlying that integrity is transparency and making sure people understand what the dynamics of the system are and how we operate as an agency. Innovation is something we constantly strive for. The entire service culture of any organization has to be innovative in order to keep up with the changes that are occurring throughout our society, and that's one of our key values as well, is continue to innovate not only in how we deliver service to our members, but also, of course, in the efficiency and the economy with which we deliver those services, because every dollar we do save goes back to the members in funding the benefits that they've earned. And then lastly, and maybe counterintuitively, simplicity. Well, it's not one of the words you often hear associated with PERS, but it is a core value that came out of our staff's definition of what we want to be known for, because while the answers around PERS are not simple, they can be stated simply. And by that I mean we don't want to hide behind the complexity of the system. The changes that have occurred to the system through its decades of life mean that individual circumstances are going to be hard to understand many times. So we want to make sure that members do have that understanding, and we strive to make our communication as simple and direct as we can so that members can comprehend the reason why they're getting what they're getting or why they're not getting what they thought they were getting. The operating principles actually came to us Mr. Cleary, my former executive director, looking at the core values and saying, okay, but there's three things everybody in this agency owns, and that's member service, data integrity, and information security. So that was the fiat of the director that put those operating principles in place, and they're awfully good ones because they are things that everybody at every element of the agency does own, and that is service not only to, of course, members that interact directly with our membership, but the supporting people that are behind the scenes that try to give those member service folks the information or productivity tools that they need. Data integrity, we know as much about our members as anybody could want to know. We know their history, their salary, where they worked. We have their personal identified information. We have their bank and credit union routing numbers where we're sending their payments. We are a rich environment for people seeking to tap into data that most people don't want to have known publicly. So we build very strong walls around not only our systems that contain that data, but our daily operations, and make sure that we keep that data secure and also that it has integrity, that we know what the data is that we're using is the data we should be using.
Mr. Chair, your comments just beg the question, how are you doing? Been hacked lately.
Senator Smith, Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, no, we have not been hacked lately. We do penetration tests, and we constantly are vigilant about our data security to this extent, and I will give you another example, if I may. We have firewalls, of course, around our system. And within those firewalls, however, our staff are connecting outward to the internet and to other places to do different elements of their work. I went to lunch a couple weeks ago and got a phone call not 15 minutes after I left that our IT staff had come and confiscated my laptop, because at some point about 50 minutes prior to when I left for lunch, I went to a website that, for whatever reason, was compromised. So they, and fortunately, I don't have much access to member data because Staff does that more often than I do. So it isn't that there was a breach, but there was a risk of a breach. There was a virus that connected to my laptop, and they had it identified very quickly, working with the state data center who we work through, and took my laptop away, cleaned it, returned it to me later the next day. So we are constantly vigilant as for such things.
One more.
Yep.
You mentioned the state data center, one of my personal favorites. And I am curious, how, given that you're such a data-deep agency, what have your charges looked like? How has your service been? Are you adequately consulted about changes there? Are you part of the group that's at the table?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, we have very limited services now through the data center. We host our operating system within the agency, but we are connected to the data center for things like internet, email, et cetera, some common services. And I will admit to some mystification as to some of our charges because the method or formula changes periodically, but we are at the table to get those questions answered and to get those clarifications. But we are not as heavily engaged with the data center as some other agencies whose systems are hosted by the data center.
Thank you.
So the mission statement, vision, values, and operating principles all give aspirational statements about what it is we hope to be as an agency. That obviously begs the question, how you doing? Are you accomplishing your mission? Are you supporting your values? Are you executing on your vision? So we have established key goals and outcome measures that quantitatively tell us where we are progressing and failing to progress in the execution of those elements of our agency. And the outcome measures that we have identified, many of them tie closely to the key performance measures that this legislature has established for us to report on every 2 years in the budget cycle. So you see in this slide how some of the outcome measures relate to the KPMs that we've been given. On the next slide, this is taking those operating and supporting processes off the map and giving you a little better idea about how we've organized the map in the work that we do. So on the left side, that's our operating process, the unique things that we do as an agency. We manage our client data and services. We collect contributions from our members and employers. We assess benefit eligibility when we process a benefit application. We calculate a benefit, and then we pay it. Simplistically, that is the work of the agency. That work, though, is supported by supporting processes, which are more common processes that any sort of agency has that support its work. And those are issues of communication internally and externally, processes for managing our compliance and risk, the process of leveraging our technology, managing our finance and resources, managing and developing our workforce, and strategic and operational planning. So those are the two sides of the map. And why we make a point of mapping this out and identifying the work that we do is driven, from my perspective, predominantly for accountability. If I want to know why and how we are either falling short in something or doing well in something or need to improve in something, I need to know who owns that something. So we have tried very hard to make sure that accountability and ownership of processes is aligned to our executive leadership team and through our executive leadership team to the managers in our agency. So if there's a concern that Representative Smith raises about a constituent who has a problem with an estimate, I know where to go in my agency to find the person accountable for that issue.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This brings up an interesting question. Some businesses in the community have a get-out-of-jail-free card policy, which is to say that people on the front lines are empowered to do what they need to do within reason, pretty broad range of reason, to keep the customers happy, right? And
right.
To make decisions independently. Obviously, there are times when that's appropriate and times when it's less appropriate. And I'm interested hearing you say that to think about how much are you empowering people and giving them the tools that they need to fix problems as they arise or to strongly recommend changes in processes even if they're not at the management level. So could you talk a little bit, if that's appropriate, I'd be really interested to hear about that.
Co-Chair Smith and Senator Steiner Hayward, that is one of the driving principles of this management system. And you, in driving accountability, you drive it as close to the interface as you can. So there are, of course, limits on that. My phone staff, unlike that of Zappos, can't give you free shipping. you're entitled to the benefit to which you're entitled.
Right.
But they can certainly, they are certainly engaged and brought into the conversation around our processes to know when and how those can be better. One of the measures we have as far as our outcome measures is what is the relative ratio on a problem-solving team or a breakthrough team of represented staff, and we want that as high as it can be because those, again, are the people closest to the problem, ergo best aligned to develop the solution. So it's certainly an evolving conversation. We're trying to change the climate of our agency from a paternalistic one where everything had to go up the chain to somebody to make a decision to one where individuals, staff, understand their accountability and understand what range of opportunity they're allowed or authority they're allowed to resolve those kinds of problems. So I think by mapping this out, and as you'll see in the performance and outcome measures, it makes those sorts of parameters more clear to people and lets them understand, I think, what we're counting on them to get better at and how we're trying to get them involved in defining what better means.
Thank you very much.
So that leads me to our performance and outcome measures. The outcome measures and performance measures are where we look at how we are performing on a quarterly basis. So every quarter, we get together in a management team meeting to review some 80 measures that reflect to our performance and how well we're accomplishing our targets in specific areas. And, you know, nothing magic about the indication of health. Green means we are at or above our acceptable levels. Yellow means there's something that needs attention. We're kind of not quite to where we need to be. And red means we're falling well below what we consider to be a problem area. So necessarily, those QTRs, quarterly target reviews, involve review of the yellow and red measures. And individual managers have accountability for those measures and come into those quarterly meetings with reports on why the measure is red for that quarter or yellow and what their plan is to move out of that status. Sometimes it's driven by things, of course, that can't be resolved in a quarter, but that discussion is what leads to the strategic initiatives that LFO staff alluded to, where we see there's a trend here, a bigger problem we can't solve just by trying to make a process better or improve the technology around it. We actually have to devote additional resource to it. And that's what drives the conversion to the policy option packages and the budget requests that you've seen.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Johnson.
So you've displayed this slide, which of course just begs questions. That's 35-45. You've got 35% that needs work and 45% that's performing as expected. What were the key indicators that gave you this much of a negative report, because I would consider yellow and red both not good?
So, Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, in the appendix to this report is our quarterly target review for the end of 2014. And you'd have to go, I don't mean to deflect your question, but you'd have to go through that report to see where the red and yellow elements show up. And they're very
I guess I know there's a pony in there. Just don't make me dig for it. Give us the kind of 100,000-foot view so that we get a sample of what it is that you're...
Okay. So one of the challenges we have is when our main technology tool does not support the transaction that we're trying to execute. So you'll see in our policy option package 104, changes to the technical changes to that package to allow us to pay down our technical debt and improve functionality within the system. And what that yields when technology doesn't support our processes is what we call manual checks. They are checks that need to be forced through the system rather than being calculated and flowing through naturally. Forcing something through the system takes more people to do and raises risks of raises risks because you're changing the information that's in the system because it isn't deriving the solution it needs to derive. So that's one 10,000 foot level. Fix the technology so it flows more quickly. Another area is volume. And so you'll see, for example, our POP 103 deals with data verification requests. There we have a target that when a member submits a data verification request, we want to provide them that within 18 months. We never do that. We are at 0% on that target. And that is driven because of the volume of people that have requested that service from us and the number of staff we have devoted to that. So we'll get into a lot more detail when I get to POP 103, but that's an example of where this measure tells us, here's a red problem. We throw process improvements at it. We throw technology improvements at it. It gets us only so far, and then we have to come to a different allocation of resources to just get more people to solve the problem, because that's the last thing that we have as a solution. And also in that resource allocation discussion, we need to make sure we're paying attention to the right things. So another 10,000 foot level reason why some measures are red or yellow is because we tolerate it. We look at an outcome, for example, where perhaps we have a measure, for example, of how many invoices to employers are more than 30 days old. We have a circumstance that arises that gets us out of whack with that invoice, and that goes back to maybe a change in the invoicing system that we put in place in August. That's going to run that number up. It's going to get reported out, but we know that's going to bleed out over time. We know that's going to get corrected. So we only need to know the cause. We don't need to necessarily put a solution in place.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So as the senator pointed out, 80 measures that we look at. And the other thing I want to make a point of, as you point out, yellow and red do mean that there's something you need to pay attention to. But as I was explaining before to LFO staff, we use this process to fix the problem, not fix the blame. So it's hard sometimes for people to come to a meeting of their peers and report on why their area is not performing up to our target. We try to move that conversation to how are we going as a collective agency to resolve that problem, and what resources can we bring to bear or tools can we use to make that outcome better, rather than trying to fix a blame for a problem on any particular individual. So when you see yellow and red, those are not necessarily to us areas to panic, they're areas to fix. And sometimes the targets are set aspirationally, so we know we're not going to get there tomorrow. We want to keep it on the radar, though, so we set the target at a place where we're trying to get to, not to a place that we can necessarily achieve. So the next slide tells you a little more detail, and Senator Johnson, back to your point about where some of the 10,000 foot level indications are. This is a slide that is representative of some of the measures we would look at in a quarterly target review. So the first one, if you look on the left, it's the legend, says new payees receiving payment within service goals. And by that I mean we have, for example, a key performance measure that says that you have given us, it says you want 80% of Tier 1, Tier 2 retirements to be paid within 45 days. So that's a goal we try to achieve. But it's not a complete goal, because we do more than retirement benefits, and we do them to more people than Tier 1 and Tier 2 members. So we have one measure that looks at how we do on the KPM. This is a measure that looks at all the other service payments that we make, withdrawals, for example, or OPSERP retirements. And as you can see, we're not to that 80% goal consistently with this performance. So that drives one of the elements of our policy option package, which says we want to have another retirement counselor to do OPSERP retirements, because OPSERP is a growing part of our portfolio, and more people are retiring out of OPSERP. Eventually, we're going to shift, of course, people doing Tier 1 and Tier 2 calculations are going to go over to OPSERP calculations, but we still have a whole lot of Tier 1 and Tier 2 people running through the system. So that POP is an attempt to balance this outcome to make sure that we can get more consistently up into the green range of over 80%. Data verifications within 180 days. I alluded to that earlier.
Senator Whitsitt.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Chair Smith. The thing that's striking in that first bar graph is the difference between the 2014 quarter one and the 2014 quarter three. It's from 67 to 96%. What happened there?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Whitsitt, a number of things. For one, we had people that were coming off of the high peak retirements we had in 2014. So a lot of people retired in 2014. Our only legislative directive is get those people out in 45 days. So we often delay work or shift resources over to that process to make sure we get closer to meeting that goal. That puts some of the other work behind. Okay. And so now that we dug out of that, we can pay attention to that and get back up. Data verifications is the second one, and that goes back again just to an issue of volume that I'll cover more again when we get to POP 103, but it just shows you how closely we track and when we use this information to develop our strategic priorities. And then the last one, of course, has to be the percent of retirees that that are satisfied with our retirement process. Again, that's where we start to get into some of the tools we'd like to enhance so that the retirement process runs more smoothly. And I'll tell you, probably one of the key drivers of retiree satisfaction is how soon do they get their benefit. So the more that we can get them their money faster, the more satisfied they are. Although when we contact them for the survey, we say this isn't about how fast, it's about the application process and all that. It comes down to, did you get your benefit? Everything's great. I haven't got my benefit yet. I'm still a little ticked with you. Okay, we get that. So this is how we use the QTR reports and the reports out of our management system, the outcome and performance measures, to drive our priorities in strategic planning. So the next slide shows you what we've developed as our 2015-20 strategic plan. Across the top are the areas thematically where we will emphasize our efforts over the next 5 years: organizational management development, member services and communication, data reliability, and information technology. Down the left, or broken out as the focus areas, are areas within each of those themes where we will have, again, special efforts or particular strategic initiatives that we will institute to try to make improvement in each of those focus areas. So the strategic plan does a couple of things for us as an agency. For one, of course, it gives us a roadmap for where we're going in the future. When we are trying to develop our initiatives and our plans for where are we going to work above and beyond what we do just to do the day-to-day work of the agency, this strategic plan tells our staff, tells you, and tells any of the other stakeholders the areas where we have identified that we need to have special engagement in over the next 5 years. And it is supported, as LFO staff alluded to, by the outcome and process measures that tell us these are where we need to improve. So, well, the point I wanted to emphasize in our strategic plan is how the policy option packages that we have in front of you are linked to that strategic plan. So let's look at POP 101, which is our current service metrics staffing. This is a request for additional staff to maintain current service metrics that we have achieved or hope to improve upon over the next biennium. So we're asking for 6 additional permanent positions. The main ask there is for 4 call center staff. I think Senator Johnson, you earlier alluded to the volume driven by, or maybe it was Senator Steiner Hayward, over how often the legislature talks about PERS. Does that drive more people to come to talk to you? Yes, Senator Steiner Hayward, was you looking at that transaction report? The answer to that is yes. But the answer also is that it's not abating. Whereas we used to have peaks and valleys between legislative sessions. Now we are simply to the point where there are so many people eligible to retire that our call volume is higher than it has been historically. And again, there's nothing you can do but have more people to answer a phone. You can try all the web tools you want. You can try all the menus that you want to direct people to pre-recorded answers. When someone wants to talk to, when a member wants to talk to someone at PERS, they're going to want to talk to someone at PERS. So we came to you in November of 2013 for limited duration positions for these four call center staff. And the statistics you see reflected there show how much better 2014 was for our call centers as far as the metrics that we performed with the addition of those staff. But let me break it down even a little further, because those are annual figures. Granularly, it's even more dramatic. If you just look at 2014, we got the authority from you in November of 2013 to hire those staff. And it took us a while, of course, to hire the four individuals, to train them adequately to be answering phone calls from our members and to put them into operation. That happened at the 1st of March in 2014. So in January and February, our abandonment rate was 44%. Almost half the people who called PERS in January and February of 2014 hung up without getting somebody to talk to them because they waited so long for an answer. That average wait time was 25 minutes. People that hung on long enough to get an answer waited 25 minutes to talk to someone. We deployed four call agents in March. From March to December, the rest of the year, that abandonment rate went down to 6.8%, from 44 down to 7%. And the wait time went from 25 minutes to a minute 25.
First of all, yay team, obviously. Glad we what we did help. We're hearing similar numbers from the health authority actually now, and that's really making made some amazing progress in a very short period since Ms. Saxon took over there. But I would love to see those data in a little bit more granular way, because it looks, just looking at 2013 to 2014, as if there's not a very substantial change. And I was about to ask you why, if the average wait time only went down 8 seconds, you dropped a little over 7% for your abandonment rate. But it sounds like there's a lot of seasonal variation and things like that, because if it was back up to 44% in the first couple of months of 2014, then... So at some point, I'd be curious to see a little bit more granular for 13 and 14, if that's easy to provide.
It is, and I that's why I wanted to take the time to point it out, because on an annual basis, it doesn't look like that much. But January and February coincided with the turning off of tax remedy for the first time to a number of members who were receiving it. So we had a huge uptick in call volume.
Okay.
And that drove our numbers, as I explained, to very unacceptable ranges. And in the minute we put those four additional staff on the phones, and it just turned around immediately. And my only plea to you is, let me keep that good service level to members, because where the volume is tracking consistently around 11,000-12,000 calls a month. And we can maintain these metrics if we can keep those four staff. If those four limited duration positions expire at the end of this biennium, we will go back to the sort of abandonment rate and wait time that you see in 2012 and 2013. And we just don't want to go back there.
So what if you added an additional, a six person, not the custodial, but a six? Could we take it from 5 minutes down to three? Could you take it to two? Because to me, 5 minutes is still a long time to be hanging out on the phone.
Co-Chair Smith, that's...
And I appreciate the good work, so I don't want to...
Yeah. Co-Chair Smith, that's an average, and it varies depending on some seasonality. For example, when we send out annual statements in May, we'll get a large volume of calls.
Okay, so, I mean, let's play with that.
I
could be sitting on the phone for 17 minutes.
Yeah, as Senator Steiner Hayward said, she wanted a little more granularity. We've got that, and we'll provide it to you. That shows you a breakdown over, like, the last 12 months. You can see some of the peaks and valleys.
Is there a way to bring a part-time person in during those peaks?
Co-Chair Smith, we do, particularly when we foresee some sort of these changes like annual statements, we will bring other staff in to answer only questions related to annual statements, and that will help at times. It's a strategy we exercised previously, maybe not the last year or two, because it hasn't been the event that it used to be. But we do try to measure about that.
Well, it's hard. I'll follow the co-chair's lead, and let's get that additional information. And Madam Co-Chair, maybe you and I can take a look at it.
Yeah, that'd be helpful, because lumped numbers like this just aren't as helpful.
Yeah, we definitely are sensitive to the variation, and we do try to address it. The only point I was going to make when bringing in part-time help is you got to know PERS. So we tend to cannibalize from other areas in the agency and say, can you give us a day on the phones answering questions about annual statements?
And I get that. I'll go right there. 1 second, Senator. If I'm on the wait list for 1 minute, I'm happy. But I got to tell you, if I'm on the other end of the average of 17 minutes, and I'm asked to conduct that survey, you start to get grouchy. Senator Johnson?
Conversely, if I'm on for 5 minutes or six and I get accurate information, I'm happier than if somebody blows through the agency during peak times and gives me bad info.
That's true.
And I make planning decisions based on the bad information. Then I'm really cranky.
Yeah, that's true.
That's true.
All right, let's continue here.
So one other in that POP 101, one other retirement counselor for OPSERP calculations, as I say, 58% increase in OPSERP retirements. That's still a small segment, admittedly, but it is a growing segment and one we want to make sure we get adequately resourced, because we'd like to get the OPSERP retirements to that 80% and 45-day standard. The custodial staff is just a transition. DAS changed its business model, and we just took the guy who was working for DAS and would like to have him work for us.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
This committee hears DAS, and it makes me wonder, change their business model. Let me just guess, the cost didn't get less expensive. What did they do that caused you to want to hire your own custodial staff instead of contract with them?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, it was timing, not cost. This individual used to work for DAS and was given to us as a custodian, or we paid for them as a custodian. The business model they changed is they were providing custodial services at night. Conversely, they were doing custodial services during the day. We have people coming in and out of our offices all day long. Custodial services were disruptive to our business, so we said to DAS, can you just give us this individual, and then we will keep the services in the evening when it fits our business model better. So that's the shift.
Thank you.
Can we follow up on that question? Would DAS not accommodate moving that position to an evening position?
Then it created complications for them as far as supervising and management of that position. So it was
one janitor?
Let's continue.
Let's just keep going.
So that's POP 101. POP 102 has to do with integrating the IEP into Orion. Let me translate that for everybody. The individual account program is where individual member contributions go. So every member of PERS contributes 6% of their salary, and that goes into an account for that individual that is receives earnings and losses based on market returns over the course of their career. And that account then is converted into either a stream of payments or paid in a lump sum to them at retirement. The IEP was created as part of the 2003 PERS reforms. Those contributions previously went into a regular account that we used to fund your benefit. But in 2003, those contributions were diverted. The bill diverting those contributions was passed in August of 2003. The diversion started in January of 2004. In 4 months, we did not have enough time to build a system to handle the receipt and record keeping of those contributions. And then, of course, that diversion was challenged in the courts. So for the history of the IAP over those 12 years almost, we've had a third-party administrator that did the record keeping and the payment for the individual account program. And we paid that third-party administrator around $2 million a year for those services. The nature of the work that we do, however, means that we end up doing the collection of those contributions and the accounting of those contributions and the earnings credited for those contributions, gather all of that information, send it to the third-party administrator, who then has to put it into their system so that it's available to members, and can, in the transactions then that it support it can occur. And then when a member comes to us and says, I want to retire from the IAP, we have to tell the third-party administrator that this person wants to retire and what the retirement option is. And as the third-party administrator makes the payments to this individual, then the TPA will report the tax reporting that has to occur as a result of that distribution. Our POP is to bring those outside functions back into PERS. We are to the point now where the IEP service levels can be dramatically improved if we keep it all in-house instead of engaging the third-party administrator. What the third-party administrator does is work that we can do through our system. We just did not build it into our system because of the short time frame in which the IEP was created, the uncertainty around the IEP as it ran through the court system, and then we had to come out of our system conversion project that created Orion, which didn't include the IEP in its original scope, and now we're asking to bring this in-house. So the POP for the next biennium is for the third phase of that project. Phases one and two were funded through this biennium, and I'll report on those in day three and how we're doing in regard to those. But this POP is to execute the rest of the conversion to bring the IAP in-house. And I apologize for those of you that have seen this graphic before, but this shows you how the red X wipes out the different steps in the process that we would have to execute if the third-party administrator was eliminated from this process. So if this POP were funded and if we could fully implement phase three of IAP, all of the steps in this diagram with red X's through it go away, which means we can do a better job in serving our members and making giving them the availability of one-stop shopping for all of their PERS services instead of saying, oh, you had a question about your IAP, call this number, go to this website, go someplace else for your answer because we don't have one for you. So that's POP 102.
Senator Whitsitt.
All right, thank you. Mr. Rodman, will there be, after you complete your phase three, will there then be an annual savings to PERS?
Yes. Thank you, Co-Chair Smith. Senator Whitsitt, that $2 million I mentioned that we pay the TPA will go away. And this POP that we're asking for is to build a functionality within the system. We're not looking to add any staff. So the costs that we currently have to administer the IEP won't change once we bring it in-house. We just save that $2 million perpetually going forward. POP 103 is a focus on our data verification unit. This is a program that was created in 2009, implemented in 2011, that provides a service to our members to verify certain elements of their retirement data prior to retirement. When we originally submitted a fiscal impact statement on this program, we requested 12 staff members, and we were given 5 staff members and a manager for this program. We since eliminated that manager position as one of the positions that we needed to get to our 11-to-1 ratio of management to staff. So we have 5 people in this unit. And as you can see from the graph below, they're just not keeping up. Now, the data verification as a product is something I would like to get to the stage in our relationship with our members where we can solve their need for certainty and clarity around their data without this product. But until I can get the other pieces of our stakeholders in our agency solidified in that direction, I have members waiting for something that I can't give them in a reasonable time. And again, we've thrown process and technology improvements at this. We're down to members, to people, to help serve the members.
Senator Johnson.
How much of the member accountability and reliability also depends on other employers? I'm just trying to figure out, this is not just an issue that rests solely with your agency and PERS. You have to do third-party verifications frequently, do you not?
Co-Chair Smith and Senator Johnson, that's one of the complications with the data verification, is that when a member asks for a verification, that locks the data down. So employers have to be engaged to verify the information that they've provided to us over that person's career. And that is oftentimes where the process of this gets gummed up. And you're exactly right as far as accountability for members goes. Just what we can do is show them the information we have that has been reported by their employer. We want to then engage the member with the employer to correct any errors in that data before we move forward. So POP 103 is to request 7 additional staff to get us to that original fiscal impact request that we hopefully will allow us to get better service delivered to our members in terms of this product, this unit that we provide. POP 104 is a technology maintenance and enhancement POP. This is linked to our strategy for an agile technology system and better quality service to our members. The J Clarity system, as we've talked about, was instituted starting in 2003 and deployed fully in 2011 with some final wrap-up on the project that went out into November of 2014. The point is, this project, which we started, ended with HP as a partner, HP has left the building. HP is no longer helping us with this product. It is all ours and all our responsibility. Any system like that requires ongoing maintenance and enhancement. We have gaps from our project that are in the design of the system and in the functionality within the system that we would like to close through POP 104. So let me describe a couple of them quickly. The first element has to do with what we call technical debt. As you can imagine, a system we bought in 2003 that was deployed in 2011, here we are in 2015, the world has changed. You no longer have the same cell phone you had 12 years ago. The ability to...
I don't know.
Okay. My colleague to my right accepted.
Bad example, perhaps. But there is technical functionality within the system that cannot be supported. A couple of easy examples. Clarity, the system itself, works with Explorer 10, Internet Explorer 10. We have moved beyond that. Microsoft has moved beyond that in other versions of Explorer, but we don't. So we're not compatible, for example, with mobile devices or some other types of internet functionality that we could otherwise be if our system architecture was able to support different versions of internet browsers. Our letters, correspondence, 80% of the correspondence we put out to members comes out of the system. For example, if you ask for an estimate, we put the information in the system, but the correspondence comes out because it has all of the data elements that our system has in it to generate that estimate. That comes out in a rich text format. Doesn't come out in Word, can't come out in PDF, comes out in RTF.
Are you serious?
Yes, sorry. Ma'am.
Okay.
So we'd like to change that. We would like to upgrade our technology system to better support some of the modern tools and techniques that our members are trying to use to interface with us, and also that will better execute on our ability to maintain the system. The functionality gaps we want to fill through the technology M&E have to do with just holes in the system that were missed in putting together the requirements when it was first contracted. For example, OPSERP, again, was created in 2003. System was put in place for OPSERP starting January 1, 2004. We can calculate a benefit, but if an OPSERP member gets divorced, we can't split it. We need to have the functionality, obviously, to split the benefit because members get divorced, and they do allocate their benefits in that divorce. We have a benefit program that police and fire members are eligible for called UNITS. It's a special savings account that they can put money into to kind of bridge the gap because they retire earlier than our other members, kind of bridge the gap between that and normal retirement to supplement for 5 years. That is only available to people with PNF classification. we don't have a control in our system that limits who that connects your classification to that. So your legislative administrative office, for example, could submit contributions to unit account for Mr. Borden, and we don't have any way to stop them from doing that, although Mr. Borden may think he's police and fire eligible. At times, he thinks he might deserve that.
We suspect he does.
I see that, Mr. Borden.
Yeah. In any case, if that error occurs, we can't catch it until sometime later. We'd like to put those controls in place ahead of time so that kicks the error out and the employer can resolve that. So those are examples of the sort of work that we want to do in POP 104.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you. I think we had a very similar presentation in the IT committee.
Yes, sir.
Can you give us some idea how long you believe that JClarity can be, the JClarity system can continue to be upgraded, and at what point in time it will reach its useful value and you can't put Band-Aids on it anymore, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way, but when it has to be replaced?
Co-Chair Smith and Senator Whitsitt, preview coming attractions. Probably about 4 years from now, I'll be coming to you to talk about system replacement. And this POP that we have will build the bridge to there and will allow us to do the functionality better for about the next 4 years. But the normal replacement, my chief information officer tells me the usual life cycle of these plans is about, of these systems, is about 10 years. And here I am in year 12.
So, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Madam Coach.
I asked you this question yesterday. I apologize. My brain was in another universe. Because I've been asking this question a lot. What are our options for system replacements that actually won't be? I mean, for example, we spend a lot of time in this committee thinking about the Department of Revenue and their core system replacement. And they're going with a system, a commercial off-the-shelf system, that's being widely used, and their contract is going to include ongoing upgrades and improvements, and they're part of a consortium and yada, yada, yada. There are a lot of public employee retirement systems in this country. In fact, I would suspect virtually every state, if not all states, has one.
If not more than one.
So you don't have an equivalent option for that to mean that you could do this once and for all, or do you think that's what you're going to be coming to us for in 4 years?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Steiner Hayward, Clarity is an off-the-shelf system that was customized for the terms and conditions of our program. So it's a blend of the two, and it's at least at the time the technology was developed, it was a necessary blend, because while there's other systems, there ain't another one like Oregon PERS. So we have a lot of elements that are unique to us that we had to program into the system. In 4 years, I don't know what the solution's going to be.
Okay. Mr. Chair, quick follow-up, if I may.
Thank
you. So this may be asking you to do something if it's impossible, and if it is, that's okay. But I would just like you to start thinking, and we have to think about whether we actually want this to be a budget note. Since we're talking about something that you're going to be coming back to us in 4 years, I want to start thinking about it now, because that's our job. And I would love to know what we would need to change in Oregon's system to make it more similar, enough similar to at least enough other states that we could have a system that required little or no customization, or that where we could make changes. And some of those may be rule or policy, and some of those may be statutory. And I, believe me, I know all too well the dangers of messing with PERS, but some of the things in terms of process probably wouldn't be very problematic, especially if it could allow us to have the right IT system that wouldn't cost us way more than it has to. So I'd be really interested to think with you about how we could start planning for what will be a necessary, essentially, core system replacement that you just told us you're going to be coming back to us with in probably two biennia. So let's start thinking about that a little. You may well already be thinking about exactly that issue, but I'm saying if we need to make statutory changes, let's start thinking about that now to clean things up so that we don't hamstring ourselves into having to customize a lot, because that's where we get in trouble.
Co-Chair Smith and Senator Stenner Hayward, we'd love to have the conversation. And I don't know if my CAO is monitoring. Oh, good. He's at the CAO meeting, so he's not listening to this. I suspect one of the things we'll want to look at is actually splitting our system, because OPSERP is pretty plain vanilla.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have salary and a factor and years of service, and we might be running, we might get a new system to run OPSERP and then look at how do we limp along with Tier 1 and Tier 2 and all of the complexities that the history of that has created, and how do we manage maybe systems separately so we buy a cheaper off-the-shelf system to run OPSERP and move the data over there and have another construct over how we run Tier 1, Tier 2. That's the kind of conversation we need to have. Okay. And would welcome the opportunity to strategize about that over going forward.
I appreciate that. We may think about talking to the big co-chairs about the possibility of a budget note around that, so we can start planning ahead, because we all know how complicated and expensive those things are. And if we can do what we can to prepare for that and make it simpler, that would be a good thing. So, thank you. Maybe talk a little bit about that.
So, POP 105 has to do with disaster recovery infrastructure upgrades. And this is, a strategic initiative we're trying to move forward, because PERS, for lack of a better term, PERS matters. We put over $3 billion a year into the local economy. And if that stream of payments should stop or be interrupted for a significant period of time, that would be catastrophic. So we would like the resources to put some more advanced planning into an execution of tools that allow us to be more robust in our recovery from our disaster and continue our business. The question was asked about the Salem Data Center, for example. We only have a very light touch with them. They don't have our core operating system. So if, for whatever reason, our headquarters building, let's say, experienced a fire or flood or something that took the building out of commission for a couple of months, that's where our equipment is. While we have backups in their offsite, we don't have personal computers, a stock of them, or servers to run our system on. So we want to fix that. It's an insurance policy to help us make sure that business continues in the event of a localized disaster. A couple of other elements that are supported in this POP that facilitate that is what we call a virtual environment. In a virtual environment, my desktop PC doesn't exist. I have a slice of a server in our main server room, which is emulated as my desktop. So what that allows me to do is not be tied to a physical piece of mechanics, but rather I can sign on to that server from anywhere in the world, and I could be just like I'm at my desk. So again, flood or fire in the PERS building, I have 200 staff in that building that need a place to work. They can work from anywhere with a virtual environment, so long as I can replicate that server environment somewhere else. And single sign-on is just the functionality that once I do sign on to the server, I get access to everything, all the different programs that I use to run, to operate during the course of a day. Our phone center staff, for example, have 4 or 5 different programs open at any particular time because of all the tools they need to be able to answer members' questions, status, etc. Single sign-on means they just need to sign on once and all those tools become available instead of having to sign on in series.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you. Mr. Edmund, the Department of Revenue has told us that they have a backup system somewhere in Montana that they can switch over to. If their building blew up, they would be able to switch over. You have a backup system somewhere as well?
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Whitsitt, we do not. Not something that locked down and contracted for.
Oh.
That's why that is one of the key elements of this POP, is to define what that solution would look like and engage for that solution.
Comes under the heading of never a dull moment in this business.
So we have 25 more minutes.
So, thank you, co-chair. I didn't have a whole lot more detail I wanted to go through, so I think we're fine on time. Just on the slides 42, 3, and 4, give you some idea about some of the other strategic initiatives that we have through our plan that are not tied to our budget request. They're just the other things we'll be working on that don't translate into a POP. And that gets us to slide 45, which is a comparison of our budget historically. And you see our governor's request budget there in the right-hand column. You can track across and see what the numbers look like over our history, but it's maybe easier in the next slide, 46, to look at where and how their increases are from 1315 to 1517. Excuse me. And then there's further historical information back on slides 49 through 52 that show you how our budget has evolved over time. I think the main message on this budget request and what the graphs show you is we have a growing number of transactions, a growing volume of work that we're trying to accomplish. We accomplish that principally through technology tools that you have funded previously and allowed us to invest in, that has allowed us to keep up and, in fact, improve our service delivery in those areas with a minimal, if not a flat, staffing level throughout the course of the last 10 years or so. So bottom line, we are looking for technology investments that allow us to continue to that improvement in service to our members and keep the staff with a minimal growth from one biennium to the next.
Great. Thank you very much.
I don't want to. Sorry, Senator Tristan.
Before we leave this piece, I had to step out for a second. And while I was out there, I ran into a third party, and they said, what are you doing? I said, we're hearing the PERS budget. And I got an unsolicited testimonial that a material was hauled into your office late on an evening, just about closing time. It was incorrectly filled out. Your people stayed to try to make sure that the beneficiary didn't have to come back again. Every effort was made. The customer service, I'm told by this unsolicited third party, was brilliant. And while everyone was prepared for the worst, it turned out to be absolutely glorious. And I just thought I would put that on the record. That's just from meandering out in the hall a few minutes
ago.
You
can see the director going.
Yeah, I could hear that palpable exhalation.
I'm glad you took a left out of the hallway, not a right.
Yeah, maybe I could go out there and troll for somebody who was unhappy. But the person that talked to me said customer service was brilliant.
That's great.
Good.
That's really nice.
Thank you. Co-Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, thank you for that testimonial. I mean, that is who we are and that is what we do. But I think that's why we put so much work into the management system and the mission statement and vision is so everyone is clear that's what they're there for. And we have a fantastic staff that does that work for us. Thank you for taking the time to recognize them. So I just wanted to cover a little bit about comparing PERS to other systems. We engage a company called CEM Benchmarking, and what they do is look at our costs relative to other pension administration systems in our peer group, so in other words, of a similar size. And as you can see, the major cost drivers of PERS compared to its peers, there are some areas where we save money, there are some areas where we cost money. Overall, our costs are higher than our peers. And you can see that coming out in the reasons, number three, in productivity, and in number six, one of the bullet points on IT strategy, database, and applications. I want to make sure that you understand it's not that our staff is less productive. It is that they are asked to do more. And that is reflected through this relative complexity, where the dark blue bar, which is third from the right, as far as complexity of the system, and you see in relative terms, the peer median and the all median average, we are well above our peers in terms of complexity. So when I say my staff fails to execute the same number of transactions as other staff, the Montana retirement system, for example, when a member retires, there's one calculation they have to make, and it's a formula-based calculation. My staff makes three because I have to calculate formula annuity, full formula, and money match. And when my staff has done with those three calculations, our members have, I think, 13 benefit options, whereas perhaps in Wyoming they have three. So back to your point, Senator Steiner Hayward, about how this plan has evolved over time and where this complexity comes into play. If you look at those parameters that are on the right side of this slide, the score is relative to our peers, and the score tops out at 100. So we win for multiple plan types and overlays. We win for variable compensation. Nobody has worse divorce rules than we do. Nobody has worse disability rules than we do. And nobody has worse defined contribution plan rules than we do. And that defined contribution plan is our IAP. Nobody has more complex elements. And out of those 15 areas, we top out in five of them. So this is not to complain. This is only to explain why, in comparison to our peers, we are more expensive. And it's because we are administering a plan that is more complex than our peers. But to your point, Senator Johnson, we do it willingly, and we hopefully do it well in terms of the service we provide to our members, because that complexity is not something we can visit on the back of them. They did not create this plan. They are beneficiaries of this plan. And that's why simplicity is one of our core values, is because we want to make sure that to our members, the process is simple, the benefit is simple, the results are simple. So as I mentioned, slides 49 through 52, just give you some charts that show you how all of the lines are rising except for the number of positions that we use to support this system. And then we have some summaries of our policy option packages. So that was all I was going to cover today.
Perfect. So any questions for the director? So John, give us, Senator Whitson.
All right, thank you. First, a testimonial to the complexity of PERS. In 2013, when we were looking at crafting new, reduction of PERS costs, I actually read all of the PERS statutes. Call me a masochist, but it was a great soporific, I'll tell you. I mean, but that is so complex. There are so many obvious places where that needs to be, reworked, eliminated, cutouts that have been, whatever. What I want to talk about really, though, was you've gone from 420 employees with an average salary of about $42,500 in 2003-2005 to 380, a reduction of 9.5%, but a 66.5% increase in salary or compensation. And so I'm assuming that that's a little more than you would expect to see the cost of compensation increase. So I'm assuming that you have a better trained staff that is capable of doing more now.
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Whitsitt, that could be part of it. The other part of it could be the limited duration positions. And I don't know if that was necessarily FTE to FTE. So it might be more positions listed there than there are full-time positions. And that might skew the average a little bit too. Mm-hmm. So we can check into that and let you know tomorrow on an FTE basis what the increase has been. You're looking from 0507 to 1517, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We'll do that comparison on FTE basis and see what it shows.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. So we have 17 minutes. Tamara, is there any hope that you could punch out your piece?
I can punch my piece out in 5.
Let's do it.
Ooh.
All right.
I can.
Because
I'm
just
budget in 5 minutes.
I'm channeling the great Jim Carbone, who was the PERS analyst that put this budget together, and so rudely retired before session ended, before session began.
All right, so we're going to turn this over to you, Tamara.
Okay. For the record, Co-Chair Smith, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, my name is Tamara Brickman, and I am the stand-in DAS Chief Financial Office analyst for the PERS budget, and just wanted to kind of briefly walk you through the process of putting together the governor's budget. With respect to emerging issues that were important in putting together the PERS budget, the director has referred to most of these and done a very good job of explaining what led up to the formation of their budget. There's increasing workload resulting from aging member population and retirements, the complex and evolving service delivery requirements that are caused by the program changes and the new and different benefit structures, and then administrative complexities that the agency has to deal with respect to plan changes and also in litigation. With respect to the 10-year vision and the 10-year plan, this agency and all of its programs fit within the improving government vision, and that the vision for that outcome area is that government is responsive, accountable, and trustworthy in meeting the needs of Oregonians. And PERS does this by maintaining and improving services to its customers. They have 900-plus employers are contributing in the system, as the director had mentioned, and 330,000 plus members. The governor's budget addressed the emerging issues and these services by investing in staffing and technology to improve the timely delivery of services and enhance the reliability and reduce long-term delivery costs, such as the transition from the IEP or to the from the third-party administrator over to the agency itself. Just a quick conversation, and you went through this again yesterday, so I'm trying not to repeat as much as possible. Revenue sources, the 73.4% of the revenue sources for the agency come through investment earnings, 20.8% come through employer contributions and fees, and then the remaining 5.8% public employee contributions and fees. With respect to expenditures, they have limited and non-limited. The non-limited expenditures that you see is $9.6 billion. Those are the benefits that go out to the individual members that are currently receiving retirement benefits. And then all the operational expenses for the agency are limited in nature, and that's a $96.3 million budget. The director had a much more detailed page that he just referred to right before he ended his presentation on the history of expenditures of this agency. This just kind of provides you with a little bit of expenditure history just from 2011-13 actuals through the governor's budget of 2015-17. You can see the budget does increase in each phase, and also within the governor's budget it asks for and has granted more FTE, 380 FTE is compared to 367.23 in the current biennium. Mr. Rubinwood did a really good job of going over all of the packages, and so I'm not going to repeat very much because I said I could get done in 5 minutes. Just the fact that most of the investments relate to investing either in staff to help the agency address higher workload issues, or also investing in technology to ensure that there's a sustainable and efficient way to deliver those services. And I think that's my last slide. There you have it.
Perfect. Thank you. Any questions for Tamara?
Impressively done.
All righty. So, colleagues, I think we're done early.
Cool.
So, is there any other questions? Any other comments? John, we're good?
Work session tomorrow morning for 2 minutes.
Oh, that's right. So, Madam Co-Chair, you're going to be busy tomorrow with 2 work sessions, a public hearing, and maybe some additional cleanup. Okay.
Thank you.
So, it's going to be a busy day.
Okay.
Julie, are we good? All right, we are going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5034. Colleagues, I hope you have a great day. All right. Great day.